Hello and welcome to another episode of the Dan Assor Show, supported by TF Connect, Tasters Group, Terrapin and 19 Group, and the show's official venue sponsor, Carbon Neutral Conference and Exhibition Centre, BDC London, who are currently setting their sights on reaching net zero before 2030. Visit bdc.london for more information. Please check out all of my content on danassor.com and be notified first about new episodes by subscribing to my YouTube channel and by following me on Apple Podcasts and Spotify platforms. Hello, Laura. How are you today?
Oh, good morning, Dan. I'm very well, thank you.
It's just about ticked into the afternoon, actually. That's how busy a day you've had. You've lost
track. Yes. Sorry about that.
Very nice to have you on as a guest to the show. Quite a few things we're going to talk about, so we get straight into it. But the first thing I like to do to sort of bring the individual to life that's in front of me before we get into all the exciting stuff that you're doing day to day is talk about how you got into the wonderful world of events and exhibitions. Oh, not that many years ago, I don't want to age you too much, but a few years ago. Tell us your story.
Yeah, a chance encounter at a Christmas party and a redundancy that followed. Led to an opportunity at Closer Still Media, where I came in to launch the Clinical Pharmacy Congress. And it meant that I worked with an experienced event director at the time and really learned pretty much everything I know about the exhibition industry from that point on. In a very early part of my career, and I hadn't really realised it at the time, I had worked as a contra partner on Professional Beauty. But we were an association and we programmed one of the theatres. And I hadn't really, until I started at Closer Still, realised that actually that was part of the exhibition industry. I'd done a lot of events, but much smaller events, really since a very early age, probably since I was about 10, various different sports clubs that I was a member involved with. I organised gymnastics competitions, karate competitions. I was always very much the organising person in the group. And at university, I was part of the Sports Union Council. I was the sports development officer for trampolining in Scotland. And so organised loads and loads of different events. But I'd never really heard of the exhibition industry until I was part of it.
So interesting. it's very common. Most of the guests, actually all bar one, who actually did a degree in event management at university. But I think that was a more recent thing. So the individual.
Yeah, you could. That wasn't a degree that existed when I went to university. In fact, I did a degree in chemistry.
I did history. And here I am. All the podcasts.
Exactly. I mean, chemistry is not that, it's been quite helpful because the event that I launched was in pharmacy. So actually having the terminology, meant that you could have slightly, slightly higher level conversations with delegates about what was needed.
Sure. But you can pretend to know what you're talking about.
Degree is a necessary part of the job that I started doing.
So what was it you enjoyed about events from an early age? What did you like? What were the sort of things that you... Was it just being in charge? Was it getting people...
I was literally about to say being in charge. Yes, exactly. As a child, as a teenager, that I think, I don't know, that's certainly something I craved, but I wouldn't have realised that at the time without doubt. And obviously, as you get older, you start to reflect on the funner or the worst parts of your, growing up and pathway to where you've ended up. But I do know that now that I've ended up here, both my parents have commented recently that they're really delighted that I've found a niche that suits me.
Sure.
And that was really interesting when they said that, because they had actually been worried previously that I wouldn't find a niche that suited my personality and characteristics. So I think I've kind of felt like I've made it at that point.
Well, that's the dream, isn't it? Being able to earn a living doing something that you enjoy. And it's interesting because unless you do a professional qualification, you know exactly, you know, you've got that intention. I want to be a doctor, lawyer, accountant, for whatever reason.
There you go. You just mentioned my mum, dad, and brother. So, right. Yeah.
And my brother's a dentist. He always knew he wanted to get into medicine.
My mum's a dentist.
Well, there you go. That's a whole different conversation.
Doctor, dentist, solicitor. So yeah, I'm the odd one out without a vocational qualification.
So you took the leap of faith to join Close to Steel, what, almost 12 years ago? Is that right?
Yeah, July 2011. Okay. 3 weeks before I got married, coincidentally. So my first port of call was to go on honeymoon, which was interesting. But yeah, I was being made redundant from a pharmacy magazine. So I did come with the pharmacy knowledge.
Yeah.
And I was also the programmer. So till about 3 or 4 years ago, I was still pretty much pre-COVID, and during COVID, Close to Steel invested in a content team for healthcare. And that meant that I could relinquish those duties as well, which has enabled obviously other progression.
Yeah, which we're going to talk about. Now, no career is a straight line, even in one business. So you've been at Close to Steel almost 12 years. And we're going to talk about present day in a minute. But you've obviously developed your role and obviously as an individual and your skill set. To get you to the position where you're at now, which is portfolio director?
Yes, as of January.
For people listening that are maybe at the beginning of their journey, what advice, what things have stood you in good stead? Why have you been successful? Just give us a flavour of some of the things that you think, you know, have helped you along the way.
I mean, people have helped along the way, you know, but it's about finding the people who can help you or are willing to help you and aren't going to steal from you, if I can be truthful.
Yeah.
It's relationships with internally, also externally, but actual external relationships are easier to cultivate than internal ones. The saying is always, you know, a communication company is great at communicating what we do externally, but we're terrible at it internally. That's not one company, that's every company. So the same goes with relationships, having good relationships with your supporting departments. So, you know, ops, marketing, data, content, you know, whatever size company, whether you have all of those. I mean, when I started, we only had ops. And marketing, but now we've got data and digital and all the other departments. So having a relationship and being seen as helpful and not burdensome, you know, you should be able, you know, you want to be able to support your colleagues in other departments because they work on lots of events and they maybe do 3 or 6 months on each one, whereas you do one or two.
Yeah.
As a show manager or an event director, you get to focus your entire attention on one event. But you can't deliver your event without those departments. So cultivating those relationships would definitely be something that I would highly recommend. But also living your product and being, I use the word synonymous quite a lot, you know, be synonymous with your brand, be the face of your product. And that, you know, that leads on to building a personal profile, because actually your personal profile is your show. You want people to be ring up and say, oh, can I speak to Laura about the event she runs in London? They may not even remember the title of it. So but that, they still rung you.
That takes a certain level of confidence, right? You know, you strike me as someone that's confident, but I've also met people that are outwardly confident, but actually they have to put on that face. It doesn't necessarily come naturally, but they understand that's what they need to try and do. Not acting, but you see what I'm saying. You know, fake it to your
mind. I mean, I'm not acting, but I definitely put on a professional Laura, if I can put it that way. You know, I do clearly separate myself from my home Laura and my professional Laura. Though as I've got more senior in this role, the two do get closer together because you are kind of intrinsically linked. But I do, you know, I do I do have to work hard at being the person that I think people want me to be. If I don't mean that in a bad way.
Sure.
We all have to work on being exuding confidence. You know, if you don't have to work at it, you're probably arrogant rather than confident. Confidence comes with knowledge, and knowledge comes with power. But to gain those things, you have to have trust, and people have to believe in you. And that's where you have to work. That's the bits you have to work at.
Sure. And you mentioned building your personal brand. And, you know, we can log on to social media, and these days it's all about personal branding and this, that and the other. But again, you know, for younger people listening to this, and I've grown up with these sort of social media platforms. It's not just social media. But, okay, what advice would you give to someone that's, okay, takes on board the fact they need to put themselves out there, they need to try and build their personal brand in many ways, not just talking social media, talking, you know, going to networking events within their company. How do you think they should go about that without it being seen to be contrived and sort of trying too hard? What sort of things that can they do?
I thought about this question, actually, because over the last sort of 3 or 4 years, it's become a little bit more natural to me. But I definitely felt like I was trying too hard. That's not what people said, but that's how it felt. But you've got to put yourself out there. You've got to put yourself out of your comfort zone. Ask to speak at events. That's what I did. Because without doing, no one's gonna put you forward until you've already made it. You know, this year I have been asked to speak at event X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
But now I feel like now they need me, whereas 6 or 7 years ago, I needed them. So it, you know, having that, you have to put yourself out there. You have to ask to do things, particularly as a woman. You have to ask to do things, and don't let someone tell you that you're being bolshy or over the top for asking to do something. If you've got something that you think's interesting to share, then why wouldn't people be interested to hear from you? I'm a much better orator than writer. And that stems, I have dyslexic. So, you know, for me, speaking about things comes much more naturally than writing them down. I have to work, I have to work extra hard to write good prose, but I've done a lot of practice at it. So discovering what you're good at, that's definitely a tip. And find people who are good at what you're bad at. That's the other thing.
Sure.
So you all look nice and rounded.
That's good advice. I think also not being afraid of rejection. You know, if you ask, you don't necessarily
get. How the world works. People are rejected every day of the week.
Yeah. Hi, I hope you enjoyed the podcast so far. Just going to take a brief pause to tell you a little bit more about our official venue sponsor, the Business Design Centre. The BDC is London's most stylish venue, playing host to hundreds of conferences and exhibitions every year. It is also the permanent home to over 125 businesses who occupy the offices and showrooms based there all year round. Opened over 36 years ago in 1986 and formerly the Royal Agricultural Hall, the building was rescued from demolition in 1981 by entrepreneur Sam Morris and was fully restored and reopened as the UK's first integrated trade exhibition and conference complex. Today, the BDC attracts almost 1 million visitors every year. Sustainability is at the forefront of everything they do at the BDC, with a goal to reach net zero before 2030. For over 13 years, it has been a certified carbon neutral venue, and the steps they have taken to improve their impact on the planet have been recognised within the events industry and further. The BDC has received recognition with multiple awards, including Exhibition News CSR Award in both 2018 and 2019, and more recently, the EN ESG Award in 2022. Please visit bdc.london for more information. Now back to the podcast. Yeah.
And they're also accepted.
Does that go the same, you think, in terms of progressing your career in a business? So I'm not saying, you know, give me a promotion, but making sure that people understand you want to move forward, getting the agreement to say, right, if I achieve these objectives in this time scale, I potentially will get this. Does that
I think that's a good point. You need your boss needs to be clear that you do or don't want to progress. Because if they don't, if I don't know that one of my team does or doesn't, and I use both, because some people are happy to stay at X level and don't want to progress anymore. They don't want line management. They don't want more financial responsibility. They're happy delivering one show as the event director and, you know, happy days. But then there are some people who do want more. And if your team, the people who make the decisions on that, don't know that, then that's your first hurdle. You need to be clear with people that you want progression, but in a sort of open way without being demanding. And the way I did it was, right, I want to be the show manager on the show, whatever that year was. What is it that I need to do? What is it that you need to see me doing? And that's an important question.
Yeah.
The visibility of the other decision makers. So, you know, who makes the group decision on a promotion? Now, at Closer Still, the higher you go, the more board members you get involved, basically. So for the portfolio directors, the whole board will have signed off on that. So they all need to see the differences that you're making. But one thing I learned last year was you need to, you know, people are happy to give you feedback, but actually asking for what you need to see me do to progress.
Yeah.
And be ready for not necessarily negative, but constructive feedback, which is what I got and what I needed. Yeah. And I actually got the praise for asking the question.
Yeah.
It wasn't necessarily about changing what you were doing, but it's recognizing that you're not perfect. I mean, I'm definitely not perfect.
And it means that everyone knows exactly where you want to go, and then they can tell you how to achieve it, and then you can have honest and adult conversations at that point as to whether that's happened or why it hasn't happened. I think you make a good point about multiple stakeholders within a business. You know, you can easily just buddy up with one or two, and then overnight they've disappeared, and you've realised that you've marginally.
Well, they no longer have decision making, and you're like, I've burnt my bridges, or I've put all my eggs in the wrong basket.
Sure.
Doing informal training. If you're more junior, you know, sales manager, show manager, you know, putting on little training sessions with your peers. That's a great way. You know, if you're really good at something, or you've changed a process that's meant less effort for other people, do a little training session on it. You know, do it over lunch. Get everyone to bring their lunch in and spend 45 minutes talking about the process you've changed and why it's of benefit. That people will pick up on that. That's a really something that's really, really useful. Learning something new and then sharing that knowledge. I mean, during COVID, you know, we all had to learn how to do this. You know, using digital platforms, using online technology, and the first adopters in the business are, you know, people who, myself included, wanted to learn more. You know, I think I learned more in the first month of COVID than I had learned since I left university.
It takes people to step up and do that rather than just wait for others.
Just wait and go, oh, look, here you go, it's all done for me.
Which is also fine. You know, as you said, you know, there are people that will always sort of want to progress in a direction, but there are others just happy doing what they're doing. Actually, every business needs...
Well, you need both of them.
You need both, because if you had two...
Not everyone can be a forward-thinking, strategic person. Sure. You need people to carry out that strategic thinking.
Sure. So... You are currently the portfolio director. I just want to come to your current role. Give us a flavour of what that means, an exhibition organiser like Closer Still. What does that mean day to day?
Just to give a caveat, it's a brand new role at Closer Still. So until January, we didn't have any portfolio directors. So as Closer Still is growing, we're heading towards 500 employees globally, which I was employee around 2021, so you know we're growing very quickly, and so the with acquisitions that are coming in, obviously the leadership team need to integrate those into the business, and it means that the legacy shows and new launches that are within our own current framework can be done by experienced members of staff. Which myself, There's Alex Harden and Michael Corbett. We're all new portfolio directors. So pretty much all of the healthcare medical portfolio now sits underneath the three of us.
Sure.
And we've all, you know, we're all 10 plus years at Closer Still. So, you know, we do understand how the business is working. And it's meaning that we can share more best practice across our network of events. You know, as I've gained more and more events, so group event director in May 2019, the events that I took on at that point now all look like my original event, because the model that I honed in on my first event is now replicated on others. And my the launches I've done all look very similar. They have the same framework that we stick the expert knowledge onto. But from a portfolio, it's about sharing best practice as a group of shows and a group of people. Not just from me, from the event directors, group event directors, show managers within that portfolio. What works on one show, have we tried it on another show? Sure. Have we got a better relationship with social media that we can on one show that can be replicated on another? And really to try and stop us reinventing the wheel, which small businesses are very guilty of, because you work very siloed. And so as you transition to that kind of medium-sized company, actually there's a lot more stuff we can share with each other and just copy.
Thank you. No, it's useful to get a flavour of the different structures of businesses. And I've seen that Closer Still have put in these new positions. I want to touch upon something that you mentioned there, which were launching shows. And I know you've been responsible, and you feel free to bring a couple to life. You've launched new shows in your tenure at Closer Still. You've launched brand extensions, i.e. you had an existing show and co-located it.
So, UK Geo Clone.
And I know recently, you know, your best practice event, which is for primary care.
GPs,
yeah. I forgot for a minute. Has also now been taken from Birmingham to London. So would you define that as a brand extension or geoclone?
Well, it's a UK geoclone. Yeah. You can't geoclone healthcare the same way tech can be geocloned globally. I mean, tech is the same everywhere you go, but healthcare, it's different even in the UK, England, Ireland, Scotland and Wales. We have different healthcare systems. So geocloning a show internally, we did, as you said, we did best practice Birmingham, which ran for 10 plus years. But we launched best practice London, which ran 2 weeks ago, Olympia. And we were sold out.
So talk to me about that. I saw that. Congratulations. It looked really good. And I read some of the feedback. So given that's recent, talk to me about the decision-making process, because you've been doing Birmingham for 10 years. So I'm working on the basis that you probably had these conversations about maybe taking it to another location, you know, a while ago, or something that you've always thought about. Talk to me about the decision-making process of taking that leap to put it into a different region, because obviously that comes with challenges. You don't want to cannibalize revenues and audiences. Talk about how do you go through the process of deciding it, you think it's going to, you know, fly at a different
location. Yeah, I mean, cannibalization is a word that comes up a lot in the meetings surrounding these cloning of our events. Absolutely. I don't think I've ever heard the word used so much in my whole life. It's quite a descriptive word as well. So absolutely, cannibalization is a real issue. And 9 times out of 10, we can get exhibitors to come to a show if we can get the audience, their customers. So the majority of our research goes into the audience side of things. And it became very clear for best practice that we are fishing in a Midlands pond for a Birmingham show.
Sure.
We were getting some delegates from London, because London, like directly in London, Greater London, but not the home counties, for example. And so it became clear that there was actually a larger universe to draw from for a London show than a Birmingham show.
Yeah.
So it based on that fact, we did a lot of one-on-one calls. I mean, that's really the basis of this research, is utilizing a market research expert in-house to call, let's say, 50 potential delegates of varying seniority and varying geographical locations that we think would go to a London show rather than a Birmingham show. And the feedback from that was overwhelmingly supporting a second event. If we could have moved into the national at Olympia, we would have been able to sell probably 30 right. more stands, but the availability was just not there. But we've moved to the national for next year. And, you know, that enables the show to grow, hopefully in, you know, a 3-year period to somewhere similar to the size of the Birmingham show, which is what we are forecasting. But, you know, things can change in 3 years. Sure. So we're focused on 1 year at a time.
So what I take from that is you have to talk to your market. So yes. You're talking to your sponsors and your exhibitors, you're talking to all the stakeholders, which include your attendees. Obviously, you need to find a suitable venue as well. So you're talking to your suppliers, contractors, and so on.
Yeah.
Do you see sort of subtle differences in the program, for example? Like, is it in regions, so, even if it's in the same country, in the same language? Or is it because
there is some subtle differences? And so in NHS England, Department of Health, there are regional elements to the way the NHS is structured. So having NHS London, for example, being the key driver of content for NHS England versus the Midlands. And I think it's there's the Midlands one, and then there's a Northeast and Northwest, just kind of approximately, not an expert. But that's where the content team now that we've developed since COVID in healthcare, we've got two experts in that department as well, whereas we didn't have that expertise before. And so actually working closely with those, because they've got more relationships with more delegates, because they're the speakers and the advisory board.
Sure.
But, you know, I encourage all my team to sit in on the advisory board meetings. People will be like, oh, it's like 2 hours, I could be doing so much more. But the amount of information that you can absorb purely from having 10 of your delegates talking to each other at a million miles an hour for two hours is incredible.
And that saves time later on. That saves time later on when you're trying to think of content ideas and actually... Yeah. You know, it seems obvious, but it's not always done. You speak to the community and they will give you the ideas to shape the event. And I want to talk about community relationships, because you've worked, as you said, within healthcare, the medical field.
My whole career.
Your whole career. How do you continue to build and maintain the relationships with the community? Because I guess also contacts have come and gone from potential sponsors, never mind organisations and associations. What are the sort of tips and tricks you can do, that you can give, to people that are listening to this?
I think you've got to treat them slightly differently, the different groups. So if we start with delegates, i.e. your exhibitors' clients, being present, your personal profile actually helps you with this, because if you're sharing their news and information on platforms, or even in your monthly newsletters that you send out, you know, oh, this is interesting, you know, on LinkedIn, or this is an interesting article, would you mind if we reprocessed it into a newsletter going next week? I mean, no one's going to say no to free advertising to 10,000 or whatever your database is. So doing things like that is definitely a good way of maintaining relationships. Attending their events, you know, they have a lot of associations have smaller compared to our events, tabletop exhibitions, you know, supporting them, advertising those in your newsletters. You know, it's give and take, you know, we both have to give and we both have to take. And when you're launching new shows, these relationships are the gold dust. So is there a relationship you've got from another show that actually maybe they've got a bit of their audience that fits for your new show's audience? And can you then utilize that to help you with a new event and a new community that you're building? Something that we haven't done a lot of and certainly are looking at the moment is this kind of 365, I want to use inverted commas, the 365 community.
Yeah.
And by running a second version of our events makes that 365 more reasonable, more possible to do, because we have, you know, most shows run a 6-month campaign. So actually now if you've got two shows every 6 months, your campaign naturally becomes 365. You don't want to force that issue, because then it's not worth it. You're wasting your time and no one's reading it, so it's not worth it. But if you have two events, I think it'll happen organically with those events.
Thank you. And another word that was banded around sort of during COVID times was omnichannel.
I thought you were going to say pivot.
I try not to say pivot anymore in my podcast, having said it for months, but thank you for bringing it up. Are you still doing much digital stuff, for want of a better word, outside of the shows?
We are. We only, well, if you're talking about like webinars, we only run webinars on shows that get an audience. So some of my shows didn't work at all, not the right thing. But we just mentioned best practice. So last week, they still run webinars because they get a good audience to them. So if it works, carry on doing it. If it doesn't, just move on to something else. That's the same for a show. Now, if it works, carry on doing it. Do no more of it. Make it bigger.
Yeah, no point in doing it for the sake of it.
Yeah. We don't run any of our shows like a live hybrid. We do still record all the content and we use the show app and put the content on the app four plus weeks later for those who attended. And something that we're looking at is whether we then open that up to people who didn't attend, but for a small fee to cover the cost of all the work put into delivering it all. Another area of growth for Closer Still is we now have a digital team. So there we have a team that are digital marketeers and they're actively involved in supporting the show marketing teams with, you know, better traction on social media, using the different show apps, just generally, again, that's that whole small to medium company transition, is that there's more centralized functions that people can draw on.
Yeah. And that comes to my next point, because I want to talk about over the years that you've been doing this, and possibly this is more relevant sort of post-COVID, in terms of attendee, and let's start with exhibitor expectations of what events can do for them and actually what they want to do at events. How much do you think that's changed? Where do you think we're at? I mean, if you want to sort of reference pre and post-COVID, you can do, if that makes it easier. But lots of people I speak to, you know, they're telling me that sponsors and exhibitors, branding was great before, but it really is all about ROI. Was before as well, but even more so. They're being a bit more discerning as to where they spend their money, what they spend it on. Or have you not seen that? Do you think it's completely returned to what it was before?
I think people are definitely taking longer to make decisions.
Yeah.
And it's also a decision by committee. Whereas before, people would just be like, yeah, I want to do that. It's in my budget. Sign.
Bosh,
got a deal. You know, we're seeing 3 months, you know, for some of our bigger clients, 3, 4, 5, even 6 months, they've agreed something. And then the process that they have to go through to get to some kind of booking is extremely elongated now.
Right.
And that throws a lot of risk for any event business. You know, we've sadly seen, particularly in the consumer sector, B2C shows, because of the way that the ticket marketing's changed, people are buying or committing to things much closer to the event. And we are now seeing that in the exhibition industry, the exhibiting side, that people are booking much closer to the event.
Yeah.
But then you've got a very fine line of when it becomes too close to the event. And they're like, oh, no, it's too close now. I've got time to do it. And so you've got that little sweet spot about, 4 or 5 months out, I think, that you've got to scoop everything up as quickly as you can.
Well, I was going to say, on a positive point, it means that, I guess, from a sales perspective, the cycle's never finished, because you know, I guess it was always the case, but you know now that there's always budget flying around towards the end of the sales cycle, but it doesn't allow for, you know, I guess it can be a scary
forecasting becomes more difficult.
Yeah. What about attendees? Do you think that, well, you mentioned there about exhibitors, but I think you were referencing attendees signing up. Are you seeing attendees registering later for
yes.
your events?
Yeah. I mean, last year it was really scary. Really, really scary, you know. Yeah. Or even on our really safe shows, people were, or our paid for shows. So obviously vet show is paid for, learning technologies is paid sure. for, and you know, their tickets make up a big proportion of their budgets, and they were, even in those shows, people were leaving it much later. I do think that people are still nervous about whether the event would actually happen last year, but because we ran a load of our events in Q4 of 2021, we had a little bit more confidence to push back. But now we're in 23. I mean, yes, people are still registering later, but it's settled down a little bit. It's spread out a little bit more, maybe not fully back to pre-COVID, yeah. but definitely not as stressful.
What sort of things we've been trying to do to encourage people to register?
We're not doing as much print mailing, I know that's for sure. We're working very hard on our databases, you know, yeah. to the point of, you know, we're using the telemarketing team to call and clean data. We're using data companies to clean data, to make sure that what the people that we are targeting are the right people. And if we do campaigns, that they're going to the right people about the right product.
Sure.
And also definitely the help of the digital team that we've already talked about. Their influence and input into what marketing are doing and achieving is making a difference, because they're being targeted with retargeting campaigns, the pay-per-click stuff. I mean, yeah. that's literally, you know, that's pretty much the extent of my knowledge here.
We're using all the different tools available. We're using all the different tools available to try and get them at different touch points. I just want to move on quickly to sales. I know we've covered a lot, but you've won lots of awards. You've won a few. Sales Person of the Year, the EN Awards a few times, and Event Director. And I know, obviously, event directors sell a lot. What makes a good salesperson in the exhibition industry?
Oh, God, that's a question. Tenacity.
Yeah.
Tenacity and confidence, but knowledge of the sector that you work within. So something that I've always prided myself on is being able to offer guidance to clients, because actually I might know more about the sector than they do, and if I don't, asking them the right questions so that they fill the gaps.
Sure.
Questions, the ability to admit that you don't know something is really important, and say that and ask them to help you. You know, people love to talk about what they're good at and what their expertise at. If you ask a client to talk about their product, I mean, if they can't talk about their product, I mean, what's the point of coming to an exhibition? So, you know, you asking questions, pushing that one more question out. You know, you've got to the end. Oh, it was you asked an open question, but got a closed answer. Go on, try one more question. See if you can get one more question. You never know what might happen.
Yeah. And what about the tools we use these days? Because again, you know, maybe the younger generation are not so excited about picking up the phone, and it's easy to rely on LinkedIn and everything, an email. What's your view? Do you think it should be a combined approach still?
It needs to be a blend, absolutely. Yeah. Combined, but all of them for everyone. Don't just try one with one person. You don't know what they're going to respond to. I know some people who, you know, are using WhatsApp messages because that just happens to be what works for that client.
Yeah.
But the next client doesn't use WhatsApp, or they don't have it on their work phone. So they, you know, emails are for them. LinkedIn in mail is very useful. And I certainly suggest people experiment with Sales Navigator because it gives you a whole new, I mean, I think it's like an encyclopedia of contacts. Sure. And people do, you know, you often get the notification that you've got a message from LinkedIn, but you only have one, whereas you might have 100 emails if you've been out all day and you don't, you're not going to read anything people you don't recognize the name of, certainly not in your first run through of them. So using it LinkedIn mail or in mail is definitely a suggestion that I would go for.
But definitely a blended approach, which makes sense.
And I mean, interesting. The phone will all, personal human contact, having a chat with someone, you get so much, like I said earlier, I prefer to talk to people. So sure. I much prefer to pick up the phone and talk to someone about a problem, particularly because you don't misconstrue anything as well. The way you write something might irk someone, and you know, you didn't mean to, but that's how it's come across.
That's so a good point.
People.
Good point.
One of my team, she started doing it for people she can't get hold of at big pharmaceutical companies. She's actually just sending meeting requests, requesting a Teams meeting at 2 o'clock tomorrow, whatever.
Yeah.
And if one out of 10 accepts, that's one more than she had before.
Yeah.
So you just got to try all of the different things. If you're struggling to get hold of someone that you really want to talk to, find out what events they might be going to, you know, and go to that event just to talk.
Stalk
to
them.
Stalk them. Yeah, why not? I didn't
Laura,
say that.
Yeah. You have a new title as president of the Women in Exhibitions UK chapter.
That's correct.
I want to talk about that. My first question is, why the need for an organisation like the Women in Exhibitions?
That's coming from a man, so that's the reason.
I'm not saying I don't know the answer. I'm here to pose the questions.
Yeah, no, I know. So Women in Exhibitions is a group of people within the exhibition industry who are here to help empower other women to get to where they want to be. And that doesn't mean the top.
Sure.
Where you want to be could be different from the person sitting next to you. Can I open the door for one more woman to step through and make a difference in her achieving what she wants to achieve? I had to push against a lot of closed doors. We all do, men and women. I'm certainly not saying men don't have to do that, but often those doors are pushed open a little bit easier for men. So let's help our women achieve what they want to achieve through empowering them with other successful women, of which there are a lot in the exhibition industry, but they don't shout as loudly as some of their colleagues. And so actually, can we help them shout about how good they are?
So, yeah, you mentioned there are definitely a lot of women, successful women in the exhibition industry, in many roles, in many businesses. Perhaps not so much at top tier. I don't know. You might know.
Certainly in the large exhibition companies.
The large exhibition companies.
I think so, in the startups, it's more difficult, isn't it? Because you might, you know, three or four people trying to create a business. So, you know, it's about all hands on deck and everyone's doing everything. But in the kind of small to medium sized companies, I don't think it's as bad. But certainly in some of the bigger businesses, so talking to some people from at Confex a few weeks ago, you know, they're saying, well, I'm probably one of the most senior women and I'm no one, you know, in the whole the grand scheme of things. And that's worrying. That's concerning. You know, women make up 50% of the population. Yet in your company, you're running it only for the men in the business. You know, if you have a marketing team, you want to have men and women in the marketing team so that, because your customers are men and women, you want to make sure that the messaging that you're sending out resonates with the entire population, not 50% of it. Otherwise, you're restricting what you're doing from the start. So I do think there's still there's a lot more that needs to be done. But it is getting better. I don't want people to think that, you know, we're in the dark ages, but there is still stuff to do.
So it's a Women in Exhibitions network. I understand it doesn't exclude men from joining the conversations. And actually, I guess if you want to affect change, you probably need, you know, people from outside, i.e. men, to be part of it.
Because there's no point just
women coming together talking about what the problem is if you want to affect the people that can help, you know, with the solution.
The men are the people who, in the companies we've mentioned, so not every company, I'm not saying this is a sweeping statement by any stretch.
Sure.
A lot of, you know, the chaps are in those positions that are affecting change or promotions or pay rises or whatever. And women don't tend to ask for those things. And so it's not, if you don't ask for it, you won't necessarily be at the forefront of their mind. And so I absolutely agree with you. Not everybody does. You know, different conversations I've had, people are like, why have you got men in the organization? I'm like, I personally believe that first of all, we need men to change their mindset.
Sure.
So if they're not included, they won't know how to change their mindset.
Yeah.
But two, there are, you know, if you want a mentor who started their own business, does it matter if they're a man or a woman? You want to understand how the process they went through and what characteristics you need to develop to start your own business. So there could be anyone to do that. So that's where in the mentor program, it's not just restricted to women mentors. We don't have any men in the mentee side of things, but if you're a member company, you can put men forward.
Sure.
And the same goes with the training, which is all free for all the member organizations. There's no reason why men shouldn't be attending that, because it's free training, leadership training, that kind, you know, it's high level training with experts who provide their time to an organization to further their members. So there's lots of opportunities for all employees within member companies.
So it's part sort of support and training for females in the exhibition industry, but also it's part, I guess, lobbying for change. I use the word lobbying loosely.
Yeah, I mean, none of us are lobbying experts.
No, no,
certainly not me. And
I mean, over time, you know, just getting.
Yeah. I mean, we do work with, you know, obviously we're partnered with the AEO, AEB, ESSA, and now with MASH as well. So, you know, it's we are going through a whole phase of PR. We've actually got a PR lady who's working with us.
Sure.
That's been funded through the membership fees. And there's lots of articles that are being, you know, being put out in the media, both in UK and internationally. And though, you know, it's that kind of thing. It's, you know, we're not trying to ram it down people's throats, but do it in a way that is educational. But also the other thing is networking. So one, I think a few of the things I've alluded to is about opening doors. People get frightened. They're like, why are you letting people go and do loads of networking? People might offer them another job. And that's always a worry. But you need to create people's profiles, to learn to network in a safe environment. You know, throwing someone in at the deep end with a load of strangers who have no vested interest is terrifying. So go and learn to network in a safe environment with 50 other women in the same industry as you. You will have something to talk about.
Sure.
And they're not there to judge you. And so it's practice.
Yeah.
Why not?
No, you make a good point. Obviously, the fact it's UK suggests there's other chapters around the world, which I know of, obviously in the US and obviously in Europe. And I've read that you've got there's a Congress coming up.
Yeah, so
tell us about that.
To back up to the UFI conference in Maastricht in June, there is a Women in Exhibitions, the first Women in Exhibitions Summit that's being arranged by the European chapter, the sort of group chapter. And details for that are on our website. And it will be, I think it's about 100 people that it's for. And a great opportunity for like-minded women across the exhibition industry, certainly in Europe, to come together, share best practice, and network. Networking is super important to create that personal profile and build a profile in your the sector that you work in rather than the sector that your show's in. Those are two different areas that you have to work on.
And does your tenure as president, is it a year thing, commitment? What's the
currently at the moment there's no tenure requirements, which is something right. that we've restructured the board slightly so that things can happen more quickly. Sure. With a president, COO, treasurer, and secretary, so that the four of us can essentially make decisions and get stuff done. Because I think that's been I don't want to be negative, but a gripe is that things take too long to happen. Sure. Yeah. And so if we can get, we've made, you know, within what are we end of March, so in 3 months we've had articles in the trade press. We've had we've got mentee articles that are coming out each week. There's a lot going on and it's all voluntary. You know, we've all got full-time jobs.
I was going to say, where do you find the time? But obviously it's something that's important to you. So you make sure that you do find the time, I guess.
Yeah, you find the time. And it is important that people realise that it is voluntary and it is in snatched 5 minutes. You know, at the end, you know, meeting finishes early and you quickly get through some of the emails. But the more, you know, the more members that we can gain, that gives us the capital to invest in the training and the more networking events, which is what our members want. You know, when talking to people, the networking is super important. The training is great, is really, really good. But the mentor scheme is the most popular thing. So if anyone is a member and wants to be in the program, speak to your HR department, or if it's not HR, if you don't have HR, then the person who's kind of responsible for training within your business, because they're the ones who can put forward people who want to be mentees. But also if you want to be a mentor, which will help your personal profile, of course, we always need more mentors. You know, that's an opportunity for people to
ways to get involved. Just final question, final topic. I know you are yourself based up in the Midlands.
I am.
When we had our pre-chat about this podcast, we were talking about getting new talent into the industry, new talent into organisations that are not just based in London. What sort of things are you doing to sort of affect that change? Is it even possible? How frustrating is it to... you know, battle that on a regular basis, perhaps.
So I've recruited someone yesterday.
Congratulations.
In fact, this year alone, we've had four new salespeople join the team in Coventry. So Close Steel have an office in central Coventry. Reason being, Close Steel started in Coventry. The London office came second. So my team, I have... I was doing a few numbers before we came on for this. So my team has grown to 15 people, of which 11 of them are based in the Midlands.
Right.
So the team two of them, me and one other, we predate COVID essentially. Yeah. The rest of them are all since COVID happened hires or have one of them has moved from London to Coventry, move their office. They don't.
Okay. So it has been possible to attract people, and just generally in terms of attracting new talent from outside of the industry, is that something you look at, or are you always wedded to someone with exhibition experience? Because people tell me different things.
Depends which level of job we're recruiting for. Sales exec, sales manager, don't have to have exhibition experience at all. Helps if they've had selling experience. Sales exec, 6 months, you know, even if they're doing telemarketing, something that involves using a phone and selling something, we've got something to work with. Sales manager, if they've worked in events, so a chap I've recruited yesterday, he's worked in events, but completely different exhibitions. He's used to the tenacious element of phoning, you know, all the things we've talked about. So that's a transferable skill. Show managers really need to have been involved in running an exhibition, because it's a I mean, I have tried with people who haven't got any exhibition experience or any event experience, yeah, and had other things to offer the show that they were working on. So industry knowledge rather, yeah, than exhibition industry. It worked to a point, but it became that I had to essentially run the show,
yeah,
rather than them being able to say, I need help with doing X, because they didn't know what X was.
Sure.
They didn't know what the process of putting the exhibition on is. So we tended to recruit now at sales manager level, because we can, in the process of getting to show manager or event manager, we can teach them those things whilst the event director is, or show manager is running the show.
Yeah.
So there are lots of people for sales manager. But that being said, I have recruited two show managers with exhibition experience.
Yeah, so it makes sense.
Not
so,
impossible. I mean, they're both, yeah, been this year as well.
That makes sense. So what you're saying is that the further you go up the food chain, if you like, it definitely helps that they've got real world experience.
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't bring an event director in who hadn't, sure, run a trade show. I mean,
yeah,
you would have too much of a gap in their knowledge.
Sure.
And you would end up doing some of their job for them, which is, yeah, why don't you just get a sales manager then?
Makes sense.
Train them to do what you want them to do.
Laura, I've taken up a lot of your time. Thank you so much. It's been fascinating. We've covered lots of topics. I wish you the very best of luck.
I hope people find it interesting.
I'm sure they will. We wish you the best of luck with your newish role of portfolio director at Closer Steel. And
thank you.
Your role as president of the Women in Exhibitions UK chapter, if nothing else, having the title of president is definitely make it a worthwhile experience.
Yes, thank you so much. Exactly. No problem at all. Thanks, Dan.